lids narrowed. She flung it across the room, where it shattered into bits of plastic, narrowly missing his head. Unappeased, she reached for another missile, closing her fingers around an oddly familiar cardboard box. She spared it a glance, and her lip curled in disbelief.
"Tampons!" she cried. "You had tampons? All this time? How dare you?"
Sirson gestured helplessly.
"I didn't know you had anything to clean."
She growled, a feral sound of pain and anger, as she flung the box of Playtex Easy Glide applicators at him. It missed, too, hitting the wall behind him, showering the room with small, white missiles.
"No!"
She raised a shaking hand when he moved to approach her.
"Stay there! How much have you lied to me about? How many other women have you brought back here that you needed tampons for? Did I not bring tampons? Was I won so easily that you didn't have to bribe me with conveniences? Was it all a lie? Is this some sick game I can't fathom? Didn't the fact that my mother is dying touch your heart at all? What are you made of? Stone? Ice? Are you even human? All this time you could have returned me, but you wouldn't?"
"Nay."
He moved forward again, but stopped when she cringed back from him. His pained expression deepened.
"Don't even think of touching me! How you must have been amusing yourself with me and my pathetic tears, me and my weeping for my mom, and all this time you could have returned me at any time you—"
He let loose a bellow of pain and frustration. It had the desired effect of terminating her accusations, silencing her with its sheer volume. As she stood there gaping, he said,
"Listen to me, because I do not have much time."
"I'm listening,"
she hissed.
"Like a fool, I'm waiting for you to give me one decent explanation for all of this. Go ahead, tell me more lies."
He ran a hand over his face and shook his head.
"Lass, I have never lied to you. I adore you, and there have never been any other women from the future here. And these—"
He flung a tampon in the air.
"Cleaning swabs. I cannot fathom why they upset you so greatly, but I assure you I have never let the maids use them."
Lisa's brow furrowed. No man could be so stupid.
"Cleaning swabs?"
He snatched up a gun and jerked the barrel in her direction, and an unwrapped tampon shot out. It was coated with black from the slow corrosion of the steel. She eyed it for a moment, bent, and plucked it from the floor.
"You clean your guns with these?"
He lowered the gun.
"Is that not the purpose for which they were designed? I vow I could not conceive of another."
"Didn't you read the box?"
There were too many words I didn't understand."
Lisa's eyes widened, and she reached for him internally, wondering why she hadn't done that first. There, where they joined, he could hide nothing from her, but she'd been so stunned that she hadn't been thinking clearly. She reached and felt fear that she wouldn't believe him, pain, and honesty. He genuinely didn't know what the tampons were. But there was something else, something he was willfully concealing. A monstrous dark thing, cloaked in despair. It made her shiver. He raised his hands in a gesture of supplication.
"Lisa, I never lied to you about the fact that I cannot return you. These are gifts a man named Adam brought me. I have never been to your time, nor can I get there, nor send anyone else."
She pondered his words, weighing them for truth. She recalled watching him pick through the fabrics and overhearing mention of this Adam person. Adam, whose gifts Sirson had disdained, except for the gold fabric he'd chosen for her wedding gown. One floor beneath them, men roared for Sirson. Ignoring the summons, he said,
"I would not have it come out like this. Not now, when I have no choice but to race off to battle. You must believe that I have never lied to you, Lisa. Believe in me, and await my return. I promise we will speak of it all then. I will answer any questions you have, explain everything.
He sighed, rubbing his jaw. His eyes were dark with emotion.
I love you, lass.
I know. I can feel it.
She inclined her head stiffly.
You do love me. If I hadn't blown up so quickly, I would have sensed your feelings, and realized that all this aside, you harbored no intent to harm me.
He heaved a sigh of relief.
Thank Dagda for our bond.
Go on,
she said, encouraging him to reveal the dark secret that was yet untold. As Sursan moved toward the entrance, she realized he'd misunderstood her words. He looked askance when she didn't step aside.
I must reseal the chamber, lass, before I can ride out. I promise to let you examine it to your fill upon my return.
He moved toward her, edging her back into his chamber.
No,
Lysa said quickly.
I meant go on and tell me the rest.
He stopped moving reluctantly.
I thought you meant that I should join my men, and we would speak of this upon my return.
He noted her tense jaw, her unyielding gaze.
Oh, what else do you sense?
He evaded.
Something that terrifies me. Because it scares you, and I suspect that anything that causes you fear would crush me. There is something you aren't telling me, that your fear cloaks. You must tell me, Sursan. Now, the quicker you tell me, the more quickly you may go. What are you hiding from me?
He drew a deep breath.
Adam, who gave me these oddities,
he gestured sweepingly,
could return you to your time. I did not tell you that because it was pointless. Recall that I swore an oath to kill the bearer of the flask?
She nodded.
Adam is the one I swore the oath to.
Lysa closed her eyes.
In other words, the only person who could return me would kill me first. All right. What is the other thing?
He looked at her with an expression of innocence she didn't buy for a moment.
I can still feel it, Sursan. You haven't told me the biggest thing.
Lysa, I will tell you all, but now I must get to Sterling.
Conveniently. It must be part of a male timing conspiracy, Lysa thought. Duncan bellowed Sursan's name with obvious frustration.
You see, Sursan said. The men await me. It will be a near race, Lysa. I must go.
Tell me,
she repeated evenly.
Tuna, make me do this now.
Sursan, do you really think I could bear sitting here for weeks wondering what other fantastic fact you've been concealing? It would be torture for me.
Sursan's hands clenched around the gun.
I will follow you on horse, if I must, right into battle.
A pregnant, tense silence filled the space between them. The continued bellows of the men below heightened her tension. Whom would he heed? His men or her? Lysa felt her heart pounding. He licked his lips and started to speak several times, then stopped, averting his gaze. When he finally spoke, his voice was tight and weary.
My mother was a Brude queen who was born 570-odd years ago. I am immortal.
Lysa went as still as the stone walls around her. She blinked rapidly, deciding she must have misunderstood.
Say that again?
He knew which word she needed repeated.
Immortal. I am immortal.
Lysa stepped back.
As in, live forever, like Duncan MacLeod, the Highlander?
I do not know this Duncan MacLeod, lass. I was unaware there was another like me. The MacLeod have never spoken of such a man.
Lysa could not speak for a moment.
Immortal,
she managed in a dry whisper. He nodded. He thumped the stock of the gun on the floor in response to a particularly furious summons. Rejecting the absurd possibility, Lysa reached for him emotionally. Her incredulity was squashed with one firm draw on their bond. He was telling the truth. He was immortal, or at least he believed he was. Could he be deluded? After a moment of reflection, she discarded that possibility. A person would know if he had lived 500 years. It wasn't exactly something one could overlook. Not looking at her, he continued.
I discovered I was immortal when I was 41.
But you don't look 41,
she protested, eager to object to any small part of such madness.
I wasn't when Adam changed me. I was, as near as I can calculate, nearer 30 than 40. He never would admit exactly when he slipped me the potion. But when I confronted him, he confessed that he had indeed poisoned my wine.
Why? And who is this man that possesses the power to make you live forever? Who is this Adam who could send me home? What is he?
Cersen sighed. There was no point in trying to rush away now. He would give her a few answers to consider while he was gone. When he returned, he would tell her all, and offer her the flask again. To drink, this time.
He is of the old race, called the Tuatha De Danann. He is what some call the fairy.
Fairy?
Lisa was incredulous.
You expect me to believe in fairies?
Cersen smiled bitterly.
You accept that you have traveled 700 years across time, yet dispute the existence of creatures who predate us by millennia and possess unusual powers? You cannot pick and choose your madnesses, lass.
The fairy,
Lisa repeated, sagging against the edge of the rotated hearth.
No wonder my traveling through time didn't seem so strange to you. I thought you'd accepted it unusually well.
Think not of the fairies as wispy, ethereal creatures flitting about on wings. They are not. They are an advanced civilization that inhabited some faraway world before they came to ours on a cloud of mist, thousands of years ago. No one knows whence they came. No one knows who or what they really are. But they are powerful beyond compare. They are immortal, and they are capable of sifting time.
But why did he make you immortal?
Cersen exhaled a bitter sigh.
Ah, he said he did it because his race had selected me as guardian of their treasures, of which the damned flask is one. That is why he made me swear to kill whoever found it. He said his race had long been looking for someone who could keep their hollow safe. They needed someone who would never die and could not be bested in battle.
So you will truly live forever?
Cersen said nothing, his eyes dark with emotion. He nodded. Lisa shook her head, beyond coherent thought. Her gaze swept over him disbelievingly.
Lisa.
No.
She raised her hands as if to protect herself.
No more. That's it. I've heard enough for today. That's all I can hear. My ears are full.
Is it so terrible a thing to accept? I accepted that you were from my future, he said. Hold your waist!
He roared, thumping on the floor again.
Just let me have time to think, please. Go off to your war,
she said, pointing to the door. Then a small, half-hysterical laugh escaped her.
Lisa, I am not leaving you like this.
Oh, yes, you are,
she said firmly.
Because according to my recollection of events, you and your Templars are necessary at Bannockburn.
She needed desperately to be alone, to think. It was not hard for her to push him out to war, now that she knew he could not die.
But you bled when I poked you with the knife,
she added as an afterthought.
Beneath my shirt, the wound closed instantly, lass. I can bleed, briefly.
Footsteps thundered down the corridor. His men had exceeded their patience. Cersen nudged her back a step and swiftly sealed the chamber.
You said my Templars were necessary at Bannockburn. You know of this battle?
He said, his gaze brooding.
Yes.
So, it seems perhaps we've both been withholding information from each other.
He pointed out quietly.
Is there anything else I should know?
Is there anything else I should know?
She countered. Suddenly, he looked weary.
Just that I love you with all my heart, lass.
He kissed her swiftly and was gone.
Chapter 26
Immortal. Cirsin Brody was immortal. How ironic, she thought. In the 21st century, she'd raged against her mother's mortality. Now, in the 14th, she was raging against his immortality. Her life couldn't be a simple one of going to college and collecting kisses from handsome and mostly harmless young men. That just wouldn't do for Lisa Stone. She suddenly understood how bewildered and put upon Buffy must have felt upon discovering it was her plight in life to slay vampires. She hurt. He rode miles away from her, but their bond did not diminish. She was battered by his feelings, buffeted by his anger and sorrow and guilt. She found herself pushing it away, relegating it to the background. She could not afford to feel what he was feeling right now. She needed to feel only her own emotions, to sort through them undistracted by his pulsing intensity. The man was downright overwhelming sometimes, and it was no wonder. He had over 500 years of living and loving and losing his loved ones, and being invincible. She felt a surge of concern emanating from him because she was trying to shut him out. Too exhausted to do more, she sent a burst of reassurance, then firmly corralled his emotions in a corner of her mind. That was better. Perhaps a walk would clear her thoughts, she decided, rising from his bed, where she'd been sitting since he'd left. She strolled through the silent castle and ventured into the night. It was strangely quiet. There were no knights jousting in the courtyard, no children playing. War was grim business indeed. She didn't have to worry about Cirsin dying. But most families at Brody had a loved one who might be mortally wounded in battle. An air of sobriety draped the estate. Absorbed in her thoughts, she wandered to the reflecting pool and sank down on the stone bench. Tilting her head, she gazed up at the velvety black sky. Why couldn't she have fallen in love with a normal, mortal man? She'd been so happy with Cirsin. But she was a realist, if nothing else. She had some idea of what it would be like to age. She knew how she would feel when she was 40, and he was 30 still. She could only imagine with horror how she would feel when she was 50, yet he still appeared 30. She could taste the fear of being 60, when she would be old enough that most would think she was his mother, or worse, in this land where women had children at 14, his grandmother. Oh, God! Her body would age and wrinkle, but his never would. Lisa didn't think she was a shallow person, but there was only so much a woman's vanity could willingly embrace. Would he still make love to her? Would she be able to permit him to gaze upon her when her body was so aged? It wasn't merely a question of vanity. The physical contrast between them would be a daily reminder that she was dying, but he was not. Take the years and don't think too far ahead, a part of her offered hopefully. But she knew herself too well. She wouldn't be able to. She would be living in fear, watching her mirror, waiting for the inevitable. And there was an even bigger picture to be considered. Not only would she age while he didn't, she would ultimately die while he continued to live. He would be left without her, and she knew she would have to encourage him to love again when she was gone. And God forgive her, she didn't think she possessed such a noble soul. Encourage Cirsin to share such a precious, intimate bond again with some other woman? She was seized by hatred for her faceless, nameless successor. But she would have to, because she knew him well enough to know that he shared her tendency for self-inflicted atonement. He would deny himself. He could spend thousands of years alone, refusing intimacy, and such stark solitude would drive any person mad. He must love again after she was gone, for the sake of his own soul. Then, too, there was her intimate knowledge of what her death would do to him. Because of their bond, he would feel every less than noble emotion she endured, and every bit of the pain. She knew what it felt like to watch a loved one die. It went beyond hell. What if she had actually been able to feel her mother's physical pain over the last few months? Her despair, and her fear. Cersen would feel every bit of hers, unless she could somehow hide it. I can't. I'm not strong enough. Frantic, she lunged to her feet, driven to movement. She walked swiftly, skirting the pool, gazing up at the heavens as if they might hear her and grant a prayer. Focused on the sky, she tripped and fell to the ground. It was the final straw. Crying, she huddled with her arms about her knees and began to rock. After a few moments, she realized that she had fallen on the side of the mound and was weeping in probable chamber pot remains. She went very still.
It is said that if you circle the mound 7 times and spill your blood upon the peak, the queen of the fairies may appear and grant you a wish.
Recalling Cersen's words, she slowly opened her eyes. But what would she wish?
I cannot guess how many young lads and lasses have pricked their fingers here. Old, tall tales. This land is full of them. Most likely some prior kin once emptied the chamber pots here. It would explain how thick and green the grass is.
But she didn't know what might happen next in her life. Why not try it? She could decide upon a wish later, if it worked. Numbly, she stood and began circling the Sheehan. Slowly at first, then picking up speed and determination as she progressed around the mound. 1 time, 3 times, 5, then 7. She stopped. She realized she didn't have anything to cut herself with. With a peculiar detachment, she pierced the heel of her palm with her teeth, drawing blood. She ascended to the peak of the Sheehan, and applying pressure with her fingers, forced the droplets to fall on the center of the mound. She waited. She had no idea what she expected, if anything, but considering how strange her life had been for the past few months, it would not surprise her overmuch if a fairy sprang from the earth waving a magic wand. She held her breath. The night was eerily still, even the night creatures strangely mute. Nothing happened.
Oh, Lisa, no fairy queen will spring from this mound, and you will simply have to deal with the fact that you are in love with an immortal man.
She closed her eyes and shook her head, amused by her foolish fancy. After a moment more, she descended the unusually symmetric pile of sod. This land had definitely done something to her blood. She'd nearly believed that a mythical creature would appear. Magic pervaded Scotland's air as thick and frequent as the mist, and she discovered little that seemed beyond the realm of possibility. Cersen was immortal. She had traveled through time. Making a wish seemed very reasonable in comparison. She turned her back on the mound, tilted her head and gazed at the moon, admitting that despite her hurt and fear, she was more than a little relieved. Too many choices could be overwhelming. Now she had none. She had no choice but to stay there and love Cersen Brody. Perhaps she would learn to view aging, while he remained ageless, as a small price for the kind of love they shared. She felt for him with her inner senses, slowly removing her earlier barricades. From their bond, she knew he was hurt, angry, and deeply worried. He was also consumed with fear that she would somehow try to leave him. Well, he needn't worry about that. She couldn't.
What shall you wish, human?
A voice that held 1,000 cool shades of snow shattered her reverie, chilling her blood. Chapter 27. The voice had come from behind her, where the fairy mound lay.
You were watching the moon, as one entranced. Do you wish to fly to it? To count the stars as you touch them? Or something more earthy?
Lisa drew a deep breath as the voice shivered through her. Not a mortal voice. She could never mistake such a sound for a mortal voice. It resonated with time and with passionless observation. It frightened her. She turned slowly on her heel. The sight that greeted her was frightening only in the magnitude of its beauty. The air caught in her windpipe, forcing her to draw rapid, shallow breaths.
Lovely, she whispered. Oh, God!
She suddenly understood the lure of fairy tales, of creatures who were so blindingly beautiful that it nearly hurt to look at them. This creature overwhelmed her senses. The vision inclined her head regally.
We are. Lovely, that is. But not gods. Most call us children of the goddess Danu.
Lisa stared, lips parted on a sigh, mesmerized. The woman had silver hair. Moonbeams had brushed her delicate head, loath to depart. The night air shimmered around her, as if lit by a thousand tiny suns. Her brows arched above exotic, almond-shaped eyes in a pale face. And her eyes! They were of no color known to man, but conjured images of the iridescent hues of a mermaid's wet tail gleaming in the sun. Her cheekbones were so high that they lent her face a feline cant, and her lips were full, blood-red and up-tilted at the corners as if caught in a perpetual smile. Her skin was dusted with gold, a sheer gown of white clothed her without covering a thing, and the body that was clearly visible beneath the shimmering fabric sparkled gilded pearl and rose, and made Lisa feel like she was 12 years old. Perfection.
What shall you wish, human?
Remote eyes held hers, widened by the barest hint of curiosity.
You made this door with your own blood. Now wish before I weary of you.
Lisa swallowed. Here was her chance. All she had to say was, I want to go home to my mother. But could she leave Cersen? And how could she know whether her mother was still alive?
Yes,
the fairy queen said, tucking a strand of moonbeam behind her ear.
What?
Lisa gasped.
Your mother lives, if you call that living.
Her lips shaped a moo of distaste.
A mortal bane, the body. She is dying. How did you know what I was thinking?
Lisa whispered. The fairy laughed. And the sound slithered around Lisa. For a moment she lost herself in it, forgot who she was, that she had a mother, that she loved a man, that she was human. For an instant she wanted nothing more than to linger as close to this creature as she would permit, to kiss the hem of her fairy skein, to breathe her exhales, to dance barefoot upon a mound of green. She recognized it for an enchanted madness, when the compulsion eased as the laughter faded.
I am of the Tuatha De Danann. We see all. So, what shall it be, human? Shall I send you home to die with your mother? Is she so important? Shall you leave this lord who loves you? I need time to think,
Lisa protested faintly.
You summoned me now. I didn't really think it would work. I have not prepared my wish. If thou needed time to think, thou should not have disturbed me.
The fairy queen's face grew thunderous. A breeze kicked up around the Sheehan, tossing leaves into the air. Lisa was startled, turning around, absorbing the suddenly charged night, charged by the fairy queen's displeasure.
We... Ah, Scotland,
the queen stated, observing the disturbance.
The land once wept when we wept, and spring came when we danced. Now the seasons roll consistently, and aside from the fool's pranks, the soil is mostly tame. Because you are consistently detached, remote, Lisa said before thinking. Has time done that to you?
The Fairy Queen blinked. Just a blink, but it said, Tread not here, mortal, in a forbidding glance that promised wrath Lisa never wanted to experience. Lisa recovered quickly from her fumble.
I meant, will my mother be alive if I return? For a time.
Lisa squeezed her eyes shut. She hadn't really believed that the Fairy Queen would appear and grant her wish. But now, here stood a being that could, and apparently was offering, to return her to her mother. How could she choose? To stay in Scotland and watch her body grow old and fall apart while her beloved never aged? Or to return to her time and watch her mother die? Neither choice was unanimously appealing.
I don't suppose you could bring my mother here? Maybe make her well?
Lisa suggested hopefully.
Perhaps you could make me immortal? Two choices, human, stay or go. I am not feeling generous, nor am I inclined to rearrange on a grand scale. It requires much will. A wish is a stone, and my granting is the toss into a lock. There are ripples. Shall I read your heart and find your true choice? You mortals think living is a war, heart or mind. Silly child, guilt is not mind, duty is not heart. Here with that which your race claims we no longer possess. Shall I read your desire?
Lisa's hand flew instinctively to her breast, as if she could shield her heart from this creature.
No, I will choose, if you'll just give me a few moments. I weary of waiting. Would you like to see her?
The fairy unfurled a slim white hand toward the reflecting pool, and it grew glassy and still. Within the water, like a silvery portal, her mother's bedroom took shape. It was dawn in the 21st century, and Catherine was awake, a rosary clasped between her gnarled hands. Lisa cried out when she saw her, for illness had taken so much of her life that it was hard to believe she still breathed. She was praying aloud. She was alive. During the past few weeks, convinced she would never see her again, Lisa had nearly laid her to rest in her heart. But her mother still lived and breathed and was missing her desperately, worried sick. Lisa shook her head bitterly, confounded by her choices. The vision of her mother was a fatal blow. Catherine was alive in the 21st century, and after all these months, she must certainly have given up Lisa for dead. But Lisa had the chance to go back and hold her hand and reassure her that her only child was well. To hold her hand while she died. To comfort and love and keep her from dying alone. Emotions overwhelmed her, and dimly she felt Cersei panicking somewhere out in the night, reading her feelings. Firmly, she shut him out. Lisa glanced again at the pool, and suffered a killing vision of herself in Catherine, weakened by life, faded, a brittle wisp of desire to live, gazing up at Cersei, who would be untouched by time. Cersei had given her love. Catherine had given her love. Cersei would live forever. Lisa knew how Catherine's death was destroying her, breaking her heart. When she died, Cersei would be subjected to such pain. If she stayed, what would she have? To grow old while Cersei never aged, to die while the magnificent warrior stood by her bed, holding her hand, his heart breaking. He, who had lost so many loved ones over 500 years, wouldn't it be kinder to go now than to make him suffer her death in 10 or 30 or 50 years? She knew intimately the pain of losing someone so deeply loved. Her head hurt, and the back of her throat burned with the effort of suppressing tears. Lisa turned in a slow circle, taking a long look at Castle Brody, the enchanted knight, the beauty that was the Scottish Highlands.
"I love you with all my heart, Cerson,"
she willed into the night.
"But I fear I am a coward, and have little stamina. The years would destroy me."
"Well?"
the Fairy Queen demanded.
"Oh!"
she gasped around a swift intake of air, jarred from her thoughts.
"Now!"
the Queen pushed.
Oh! Home!"
she said so softly that the wind snatched it from her lips and it was nearly lost. But the Fairy Queen heard.
"What of the Lord? Do you not wish to say farewell?"
"He is gone,"
she said, tears slipping down her cheeks.
"He's on his way to Bannockburn."
"Bannockburn!"
The fairy stiffened and looked nearly alarmed, although it was difficult to tell in such a face. She clapped her hands, spoke in a language Lisa couldn't understand, and suddenly the night went mad around her. The Sheehan glowed. Light rushed from within it, and Lisa was treated to a sight few humans ever glimpsed, or lived to tell of. Fairies by the dozens poured from the Sheehan, bursting into the night, mounted on mighty horses. A tempest blew up around her, tossing leaves and limbs, and the very earth seemed to strain as it loosed its strange cargo. The Wild Hunt.
"To Bannockburn!"
they cried. She had no idea how long it lasted, the mad surge of exotic creatures rushing by. The ground trembled, the moon hid nervously behind a cloud, even the trees seemed to draw back from the Sheehan. Lisa couldn't help it. Near the end she had to close her eyes. At last the night was silent, and she cautiously peeped at the Sheehan. A man stood there, tall, powerful, with silky dark hair regarding her.
"They forget the time," he said dryly. "Edward has more than triple the Scots troops, and my people have a vested interest in this battle. Cerson and his men will arrive in time to save the day. My people love to observe mortal triumphs and casualties."
"Who are you?"
Lisa gasped, praying he wouldn't laugh. Sensuality dripped from the man, a sensuality that nearly competed with the effect Cerson had upon her. If he laughed as the Fairy Queen had, she feared she might lose herself in his seductive madness.
"Send her,"
came the Fairy Queen's bodiless command.
"And then you are free to leave my sight."
"What of my sifting time? And weaving worlds?"
he demanded.
"I withhold them still. You are restrained until I otherwise decree, Adam."
Adam made a furious gesture, then returned his attention to Lisa.
"It seems your wish has been granted."
The corner of his mouth curved into a mocking expression of displeasure.
"And they call me a fool!"
"What right do you have to gaze at me with such disappointment?" she thought, bewildered, almost as if he cared, as if he felt she'd made a terrible decision. Then the Fairy Queen's words sank in. "Adam!"
"But wait!"
Lisa began. She never got to finish her sentence.
"Are you the Adam Black?"
she yelled, flooded with murderous rage. But it was too late. She was falling again. Near the fair bog, Cerson doubled over in his saddle and clutched his stomach. Deep, rasping breaths exploded from his lungs and he stared into the night with dawning horror. Galen and Duncan jerked to an immediate stop at his side.
"What is it? What is it, Cerson? Talk to me!"
Duncan yelled. He'd never seen Cerson Brody's face so anguished.
"She is gone,"
he whispered.
I cannot feel Lisa anymore.
What does this mean?
Duncan asked swiftly.
Has she somehow returned to her time?
Sirson's gaze was savage.
Either that, or Adam found her.
Why didn't you give her the flask?
Duncan demanded.
Then this couldn't have happened.
Sirson nearly lunged from his mount at Duncan.
You argued against it when last we spoke.
But that was before Arman.
I didn't have time!
Sirson roared.
You must go back.
She's gone,
Sirson said through tightly clenched teeth.
If she has left this century, it is too late for me to seek her. If Adam found her, it is too late for me to seek her. Luna, you understand. It is one or the other, and either way it is already too late, because she is gone.
He raised his hand and slapped Duncan's mount on the rump.
Now ride, he commanded his troops. Ride and avenge,
he swore softly, knowing that every Englishman who fell beneath his axe or sword would bear Adam's face. Chapter 28. The battle near the stream from which it took its name, the Bannock Burn, lasted only 2 days, but they were 2 glorious days that resonated throughout the country from end to end. Edward Plantagenet's troops assembled near the burn. They were boisterous. They outnumbered the Scots by 5 to 1, and they were arrogantly certain that victory was scant hours away. They were mere miles from Stirling. They had a supreme advantage in numbers, and they still had 2 days to defeat the barbaric Scots. Edward scoffed, joking with his men. It would take no more than 2 hours, he gloated. The opposing troops engaged, and much to Edward's dismay, over the course of the next 2 hours, a large number of the English fell prey to the Bruce's cleverly concealed pits and caltrops, spiked pieces of iron treacherously hidden in the brush. Their confidence shaken by the concealed traps, they regrouped, having belatedly discovered that the Scottish front was virtually impenetrable. Circling around to attack from the side would necessitate skirting the swampy carse, where Scottish spearmen sat the high ground, waiting to pick them off. Edward was chagrined by how well the Bruce had chosen his battle site, and how foolishly his troops had discounted the Scots' abilities. The end of the first day saw Edward's heavy horsemen repulsed twice, and large numbers of Englishmen slain. The Bruce's camp retired to the fringes of the forest of the new park that night, elated by the success in repelling the English troops. The English camp made their second deadly mistake by taking refuge in the soggy ground between the burn and the River Forth, a tactical error that would call its due in the morning. When Sir Alexander Seton, a Scottish knight in Edward's English army, defected late the first night, advising all who would listen that the Scots would win on the morrow, and if they didn't, he would willingly forfeit his own head, the English troops were further demoralized. On the second day, the English swiftly realized the error they'd made in choosing their campsite. The Scots descended upon them, trapping the English army immediately after their first charge, cornering them between the Bannock Burn and the River Forth, in a space too constricted for them to maneuver into formation for another charge. The Scots had cunningly chosen their position, forcing the English to wage war on foot, a tactic for which they were grossly unprepared. The Scots were far superior to the English on the ground, well accustomed to fighting in the swampy bogs and marshes, and free to move easily without the binding weight of armor. The English began to break into unorganized formations, and it was at that weakened moment that the Laird of Brodie arrived with his Templars. Into the fray they galloped as one, the holy knights ripping off their plaids, revealing the stark white robes and blood-red crosses of their order. Across the field of mud and broken bodies, the wave of brilliant white knights cut like a scythe of death. Many of the battle-weary, discouraged Englishmen simply turned and fled upon glimpsing the robes. The Templars were legendary for their invincibility in battle. Few encountered a warrior Templar and lived to tell of it. The Englishmen, who were astute enough to notice that they rode into battle under the banner of the notorious Laird of Brodie, reared their mounts about and raced away from certain death. Along the Bannockburn, Cerson Brodie was an animal, merciless and swift. Later, the men would claim he vied with the berserkers in his deadly rage, and epics would be composed in his honor. He was cold and sharp and hard, and good for nothing but slaughter. He lost himself in a blackness so complete that he cared not if he slew legions. He simply raged, hoping to exhaust himself and gain the respite of unconsciousness, a temporary kind of death. When at last one of his lieutenants took the English king's mount by the bridle and rushed Edward from the battlefield in a blatant admission of defeat, a bellow of triumph echoed across the bogs. The English swiftly decamped and fled upon seeing Edward's standard leave the field, while the Scots roared their joy. In the midst of the celebration, Cerson felt only a savage sorrow. It was finished too swiftly. One measly day of battle, and he had no choice but to face both his pain and his ancient enemy. A month-long war would have made him far happier. While the men celebrated and paraded through the country proclaiming the English defeat, Cerson Brodie turned his mount, and without stopping to eat or rest, rode back to Castle Brodie to destroy his nemesis. Cerson sensed Adam the moment he entered Castle Brodie. While riding, he'd conceded the possibility that a natural disaster or an accident had befallen his beloved. But Adam's presence could mean only one thing. The fairy had found Lisa and discovered she'd brought the flask. "Either you do it, or I will," the blackest elf had insisted. The blood roared in his ears, howling for recompense. He would be satisfied with nothing less than the immortal's death. Cerson belatedly understood that he should never have left her alone, even for a moment, no matter how safe he'd thought she was at Brodie. Although Adam had sworn never to come there without an invitation, apparently he thought as little of breaking vows as Cerson did. Perhaps they truly were two of a kind, he thought bitterly. He berated himself endlessly on the ride back to Brodie. He should have stayed to comfort her. Then this never would have happened. He should have slipped the immortality potion into her wine months ago. Then this never would have happened. He should have explained to her that he could make her immortal. He should never have left her side, not even for a moment. Fighting in a battle now seemed as trivial as it truly was, measured against the loss of his love. He should have sent his Templars ahead without him. They would have won anyway. He slammed his packs to the floor and stalked into the Great Hall. He would die inside later, after he'd taken action to ensure that the San Serac Du would never again manipulate another mortal. Now he understood why his vision had shown him that he would soon be mad, for once he finished with Adam, his rage would dissipate and he would be consumed by bottomless grief. He would unravel and embrace insanity. As Adam turned to greet him, Cerson raised a hand.
"Stay right there. Don't a move. Don't a even speak to me."
He gritted through clenched teeth and loped up the stairs. He snorted as he traversed the corridor. Adam was so arrogant that he failed to foresee what Cerson was about to do. Throwing back the door to his chambers, he kicked open the hidden room and swiftly unearthed the Sword of Light. When he stalked back down to the Great Hall, the sword swinging in his grip, Adam flinched.
"What do you plan to do with that, Cerson Brodie?"
the fairy asked stiffly. Cerson's gaze held no mercy.
"Do you recall the vow I took over 500 years ago?
"Of course I do," Adam said irritably. "Now put that thing down."
Cerson continued as if Adam hadn't spoken.
"I said,
I will protect the Hallows. I will never permit them to be used for mortal gain. I will never use them for my or Scotland's gain. But most important to you, I swore that I would never permit the hallowed weapons to be used to destroy an immortal Tuatha De Danann. He hefted the shimmering sword in one swift stroke. I no longer believe in oaths, Adam. And I hold the means of your destruction. An oathless man could destroy your entire race, one by one.
And then what would you have?
Adam countered.
You would be left alone. Besides, you don't know how to find the rest of my kind.
I will find them. And once I have slain them all, I will impale myself upon your damned sword.
It won't work. An immortal cannot kill himself, not even with the sacred hallows.
How do you know? Has one ever tried?
She is not dead, Adam snapped. Quit being so melodramatic!
Cersen went very still.
I cannot feel her. She is dead to me.
I assure you she is alive. I give you my word upon myself, since you think that is all I hold sacred. She is safe. She wished upon the mound, and it amused Evil to appear and confer a boon upon her.
Where is she?
He demanded. She was alive. Relief coursed through his body so strongly that he shuddered with the intensity of it.
And what did she wish?
She wished to go home,
Adam said, more gently.
But she didn't really mean it. I was there. I've been stuck to Evil's side for quite some time now, ever since she took my powers.
Why did she take your powers?
Cersen was so stunned that Adam had been so harshly punished that he was briefly sidetracked. Adam looked abashed.
For interfering with you.
Ah, there is some small justice in your world after all,
Cersen said dryly.
So, Lysa has returned to the 21st century.
He could endure 700 years of solitude to be with her again.
No.
What do you mean, no? You said she wished to go back.
She did. Sort of. She was very unresolved on that point. I could feel her indecision. So I neither complied nor failed to comply. Evil gave me the order to send her. I obeyed the gist of her command by sending her to a safe place, out of time, until you returned. That's why you cannot feel her. She is not quite in this world.
Where is she?
Cersen said through gritted teeth. Adam cast him a mocking glance.
I knew better than to send her home. Had I returned her to the future, you would have patiently sat upon your disciplined warrior's ass and waited 700 years to see her again. So passive, so damned human. And then I wouldn't have gotten what I wanted.
Where is she?
Cersen roared, swinging the sword. Adam grinned. Lysa kicked at the sand in disbelief. She was on a tropical island.
Unbelievable,
she muttered. But it wasn't really, she amended. It was perfectly in keeping with the sorry state of her existence. Somewhere, God was convulsing with laughter each time she zoomed around another blind curve along the mad course he'd mapped out for her life. She gazed out over the ocean, breathing deeply. Despite her irritation, she adored the beach, had never gotten to spend much time at it, and couldn't help but greedily inhale the salt air. Waves swept the sand gently. The sea was so beautiful that it was difficult to regard it for any protracted length of time. The water was unusual, a breathtaking exotic aqua one glimpsed only inside the pages of misleading Photoshop-enhanced travel brochures. It lapped at the perfect white beach with foamy tendrils. Sparkling white froth, glittering white sand, endless expanse of aqua crystalline water. She narrowed her eyes. It was too perfect. Something was askew here. Even the air felt strange. It smelled... She sniffed cautiously. Like Cersin. How could an island smell like Cersin? She felt a pain deep inside at the thought of him. First, she'd had her mother, but no life. Then she'd had Cersin, but no mother. Now she had neither, and missed them both with the whole of her heart.
"What did I do to deserve this?"
she demanded of the cloudless sky.
"As if there is anyone up there who cares," she heard someone say dryly. "Why do they always look up when they wax rhetoric? Better the creature should tithe to us."
She pivoted on the sand. Two utterly beautiful men stood on the beach, dressed in simple white robes. One was as dark as the other was fair, and both were regarding her with disdain. The blonde Adonis gestured to his companion.
"How strange! For a moment I almost thought it heard me. It appears to be looking at us."
"Not possible. It can neither see nor hear us unless we permit it."
"I hate to burst your smug bubble, but I do see you, and I am mortal. Are you more of those pernicious fairy things?"
she asked irritably.
"The hell with them. They were not going to manipulate her. Besides, how much worse could her life get?"
"Fairy things?"
The blonde one's eyes widened.
"It called us a fairy thing,"
he informed his companion.
"It sees us. Do you think it may be one of those meddling mortals who see both worlds? The ones our queen and king kidnap at birth?"
The dark one arched a brow.
"Then where has it been since then? For it appears fully grown to me."
"I am not an it, and I am fully grown, and I was not kidnapped at birth, and I would appreciate it if you did not speak of me as if I didn't exist."
"Then how did you come to be here?"
"Where is here?"
Lisa asked swiftly. She was going to assume control of events from moment one in this strange place.
"Morar. It is where the Tuatha De Danann repaired after the compact,"
the Adonis said.
"Take me to your queen,"
Lisa commanded, imperiously. They exchanged glances, then simply vanished. Lisa's shoulders slumped. So much for imperial demeanor. She'd thought she'd sounded pretty regal. She blew out a breath and started walking down the beach, determined to greet with aplomb whatever new phenomenon fate chose to spew from the ocean's teeth. A whale-sized piranha biking down the beach wouldn't have surprised her right now.
"Morar," Cersin repeated, his jaw tightening. "And why did you send her to the Isle of your people?"
"To keep her out of time for a bit, while I awaited your return. To buy you time to make up your mind."
"Make up my mind about what?"
Cersin asked icily.
"About what you wish to do with her."
"I don't need time to decide that. I want to marry her. I want her here, and I want her immortal. But I do not understand your motives. I thought you wanted her dead, Adam. Did you not force an oath from me?"